Radio Newark, the home of Radio Newark Sport. Weeknights from 7. Radio Newark Sport, brought to you with Smith's Timber Merchants for all your fencing, decking and DIY needs on Appleton Gate, Newark. Visit smithstimber.co.uk.
Well, after a night off and a trip up north for a 12-year-old's birthday party, we're back one day late, and we are back with a bang. It's a special tonight. Mark Woods is a former British swimmer who competed in 5 Paralympic Games, winning 12 medals. I was actually sitting next to him watching Collingham cricket, and I've got to say, I'd got no idea I was sitting next to a superstar until Rob Townsend pointed out to me, "Do you know who he is?" That was it. No problem. He's now in the studio. And we're going to... When I told you about the 5 Paralympic Games, that just touches, literally touches the surface of this man. We're also one day late. We're also going to have a bit of a roundup of the Saturday cricket, because there's only 5 weeks to go now. So we're getting very close to what they would call the business end of the season.
2 more wins.
It was also Mr. Smith's daughter. Yes, Mr. Smith's daughter's wedding, so that is not going to go without a mention. How does a Yorkshireman enjoy a wedding when he's got to get his hand in his pocket? I really, really don't know. That's
the only time I cried, when I got the bill.
Yes, I can imagine. I'm surprised you're not still crying. But first of all, I'll say what's making the headlines. It's football that's making the headlines. And what next for Newark Town, with Tony Joynes walking away 8 days before the season starts. Jamie Lloyd and Will Nelson, along with the coach Bob Shaw, also left Station Road for Lowfields. Well, the short-term answer seems to be for Newark Town is Ricky Hunter has agreed to take over the role as first team manager until a permanent replacement can be appointed. With this current situation, the Central Midlands League have agreed to give Newark time to reorganise, and their first fixture now will not be this Saturday, but Saturday the 19th, when they're at home to Askham. 2 matches tonight. Collingham take on Ollerton at Station Road, and to rub salt in the wounds, Radcliffe play Newark Town Sunday?
This is Radio Newark Sport.
So the question is, Mr. Smith, you're the professional. Who is Ricky Hunter? You don't know, do you?
No.
I'll tell you who Ricky Hunter is. Ricky Hunter was the manager of Basingham Village League football team in the Lincoln Sunday League last season. That's one hell of a jump. It really is. I'm the one that's sitting here and sat for 10 years and advocated that this town is only big enough for one Step 7
very
football.
True. Very, very
and
true.
People have ridiculed that for years and years and years. And whichever name it is, there's only big enough for one. And at the minute, it's Flowserve that seems to be in the ascendancy. They've even signed Tony Smith, I understand. There you go. I do worry, though, where Newark Town are going. In the past, they've managed to keep 2 sides going. But Jamie Lloyd, Will Nelson, 2 class players in Newark, but if they've left to join Flowserve, and I also understand that Darryl Price has put pen to paper.
Yeah.
And that's from Collingham.
I was at the RHP versus Wheatsheaf United game at the end of last season, the title decider, and Tony Joynes had announced the night before that he was returning to Newark Town as manager. And I wandered up to him before the game and said, "Why have you come back, Joynesy?" And he says, "Because things have changed." And I wished him a lot of good luck, but I didn't feel myself that things had changed much.
No, I don't.
And I do fear, not only for the results, but the future.
Radcliffe Olympic, Step 6, East Midlands Counties League, are playing Newark Town Sunday. Doesn't that just rub it in?
Yeah, it's just, it's a very, very difficult situation. But the best way I can put it is comparing the two sports. Newark R&M, what time is it, mate? Oh,
no,
7 minutes.
Right, moving on.
But no, a serious point. Newark R&M, the feeling about that place at the moment is an absolute buzz to be around Kelham Road. It's exactly the same with Flowserve as well. there's a real buzz about that football club that seems to say to me that it's really, really going places.
Good, and I hope both of them get out the Mickey Mouse divisions they're in.
Mm.
Right, okay. The big wedding. The big wedding. A Yorkshireman at a wedding.
It was wonderful. If Disney did weddings, that was it. And I would like to thank everybody individually, but there's no point because Lucy says that she did everything.
The mother of the bride, that's what she's there for.
Yeah, well, I did my bit, I made the bride.
Right, two questions. Did you stay sober?
Yes.
All the time?
Yes. Throughout the entire 9.5 hours of the wedding, I stayed sober. Not a single other person did.
And how many of those 9.5 hours did the wedding speech take?
2 minutes, that's always allowed.
Your daughter knows you very well, don't she?
That's how she was made. But the thing is that the wedding speech...
Moving on.
The wedding speech went down a storm.
Well, 2 minutes, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, they laughed at the joke, which I can't repeat on here. But Lucy okayed it while we were on holiday on the Isle of Wight. So I got away with that and then told the story about my suit.
Didn't know it was Yorkshire Day today as well.
Huh?
It's Yorkshire Day today.
Okay, then I'll tell you the story about the suits.
Well, unfortunately, the music's about to run out. So that's the end of that. Goodness for that. Right, our guest tonight. Here we go, I've been rehearsing this. Is an ambassador for the 2012 London Olympics. He is a member of the British Paralympic Advisory Panel for the 2012 Games. He is trustee of the Teenage Cancer Trust. He is a board member of the Youth Sports Trust, an ambassador of the South Africa's Cancer Charity, patron of the Bone Cancer Research Trust, a BBC TV commentator. That's the one that worries me the most. He's awarded the honorary doctorate at Middlesex University. He is a Freeman of London. He is an honorary citizen of Pensacola in Florida and is a founding member of the British Athletics Council. And he's on Wikipedia. We've never had anybody in here before who's on Wikipedia.
No.
So you are, Mark Woods, our superstar.
Well, I feel as though I've come here to learn from you two. I mean, watching the first...
You're not going to learn anything from us 10 minutes
into the show and it's been an eye-opener.
how not to do it.
Mark Woods, welcome to Radio Newark. That serves you right for going to watch Collingham Cricket Club.
Yes. As you say, somebody pointed me out to you, but equally, they said, that guy over there, radio legend,
he
said.
He's got a good face for radio, that bloke.
A swimmer at county level, Mark developed cancer as a teenager. Age 17, he had his left leg amputated as a result of the cancer and did not know how long he could live. The day after having the stitches removed, he returned to the pool as part of the rehabilitation. Within a year, he was swimming faster times with one leg than he previously had done with two. And just 18 months after he finished his chemotherapy, he was selected to represent Great Britain. This is a story.
This is a film.
It is, isn't it?
It'll be a story if it happened last year. But I mean, it's about 30 years ago. So,
don't ruin it.
And I'm going to take you right back. I'm going to take you right back now, 30 years.
Yeah.
To, I mean, a 17-year-old lad have to, A, with cancer, and B, having a leg amputation. The world was ending for you.
Yeah, it was a pretty brutal time. Obviously, you know, I knew I had something wrong with my ankle, and it had been causing me a lot of pain over a period of time. It took a long while to get the diagnosis, but in some ways it was a relief when I knew what it was. But I had this moment of inspiration when I first got diagnosed, where I didn't know how long I had left to live. You know, I think that's a common thing for people when they get diagnosed with cancer, is you don't really know what the outcome's going to be. But for me, I didn't know it's going to be 6 months or 6 years or 60 years. But what I did know is I wanted to make the most of the time that I had, and I wanted to try and be as good as I could be at whatever I did. And I didn't know what I was going to be able to do. I didn't know what having one leg would mean to me. But I knew I'd be able to swim, because I had swum for Lincolnshire. Because I grew up in North Lincolnshire, and I had swum for the county, but I'd been a bit lazy. But once this happened to me, I got back in the pool, I started training properly, and kind of one thing led to another.
That's one way to put it.
Well, I could have gone on and on, but
it says in sort of my notes, the day after having the stitches removed, you returned to the pool. So that was obviously the goal. That it wasn't going to beat you.
Yeah, I mean, I never thought it would. I mean, but that was partly based on ignorance. You know, I was a 17-year-old. I think a lot of young people that age feel that they're invincible. I certainly thought that I was, and so I didn't think it would get me. I mean, with hindsight now, I think I was pretty lucky to get through it unscathed. But yes, I wanted to get back in the pool because I knew I'd be able to swim. I knew I wouldn't have to use my crutches, and all the issues that I'd had with my leg could be forgotten about in the pool. So I'd agreed with my father that he would take me swimming the day after I had the stitches out. So I'd already had one lot of chemotherapy, had my leg amputated, had to wait 8 days before the stitches were out, had the stitches out, and then I went swimming the next day, and within about 6 months I was swimming quicker with one leg. But that was mainly to do with the fact that I then applied myself and I trained properly and I put the effort in and I had some focus and determination.
How did you find it when you first got back in the pool? Because obviously...
Well, it's a strange sensation. I mean, that happens to you at 17. You've had 17 years getting used to having two legs. And it's quite a quick transition to having one, and so it felt quite strange in the water. But if you ask any, you know, if you ask some of the swimmers at Newark Swimming Club who I've been and swam with occasionally, if you ask them, swim with one arm, you know, or swim with one leg, or you know, don't use that arm, don't use that leg, they'll be able to do it, no problem. And I knew that I would be able to do it. Obviously, it felt strange, and I was particularly cautious around turning close to the wall. When you've got a freshly amputated leg, you don't want to be banging that on the end of the wall. So the turns I was always cautious on, but in the water, it felt good to be moving freely.
So you got back in the pool, and when did it sort of occur to you that I can do something here, I can be an Olympic swimmer?
So what happened was I'd said to my dad that I decided I wanted to see how good I could be at swimming, and he entered me into the disabled swimming nationals, but he did it before I'd even had my leg amputated. So if you can imagine that telephone conversation, he was on the phone saying, I'd like to enter my son into the disabled nationals. And they said, certainly sir, what's his disability? He said, well, he hasn't got one yet. You know, it was a bit weird. It was a bit of a weird conversation. But he entered me into the nationals, and I went to them. I'd just finished my final chemotherapy. So, I mean, I currently weigh about 13 and a half stone, but I was under 9 stone. So I was very thin after all my chemo. And I won a couple of silver medals at the national championships. And they said to me, you would have got selected for the European Championships, but we've already selected the team. So I, at that point, I thought, well, crikey, I could have represented Great Britain here, had things of the timing had been different. So then it gave me just over a year to prepare and try and get ready to go to Seoul in 88.
I'll talk to you about the Olympics in a couple of minutes ish. We tend to jump around a little bit. Disability sport, which I hate the term, I really do.
The English language isn't geared up for talking about things like that.
It's not, I really do hate it. The one comment I make, and it's one that I've made enough times, but I'll make it again, is when Tony was sports editor at the Advertiser, he always used to say, if anything happened with one of the disability sporting clubs in Newark, it went onto the news pages and not sports pages. Mm. Now it goes into the sports pages, and looking down your long list of what your hobbies are, what you do in your spare time or whatever. The Trustee of the Teenage Cancer Trust, how important is sport to a teenager who has just lost everything almost?
Well for me it was crucial. You know, I was a sporty kid. I could turn my hand to everything, but I wasn't brilliant at anything in particular. I mean, I probably could have been much better at swimming had I trained properly. But sport was a way of escaping from the place I'd found myself in. And that's why I support some of the charities that I support. So charities like Teenage Cancer Trust, charities like the Youth Sport Trust, who are actively trying to create positive experiences for young people via sport and physical activity. It doesn't suit everybody, but there are people out there that that the sport and physical activity is the one area that they can excel in. And for me, it was certainly the one area where I could, like I say, escape from this whole having cancer nightmare that I found myself in.
Tony's said numerous occasions in the past how proud we are in Newark of the clubs that we've got, the basketball club, the Jaguars, the 4As, the kayaking club, and we are so proud of them, and they've helped an awful lot of youngsters put themselves forward, and not just youngsters that's with cancer. We had young lady Natalie Blake, a weightlifter, and she was in last week, and she's been to 5 Olympics as well, 5 Paralympics, and Natalie's world is weightlifting. It's given her sport, it's given her a goal. And have you seen it change? Tony will tell me from his perspective, it's changed over the last 20-25 years, the whole ethos of, you know, you're disabled, we don't want you in our club, to you are disabled, let's get you at our club and bring you into it and make you part of it. And I think that has got to be something in sport that they've finally grasped, and they've got it right.
It's changed on many different levels. So if I think about, you mentioned clubs saying we don't cater for people with disabilities. I can remember in 2000, when you'd think we were moving forward at that point, I can remember calling up a coach because I'd moved up to Manchester, and a coach saying, we don't do disability here. I'm like, wow, okay. You know, the fact that you've said that to me means you are not the right coach for me. But it's pretty appalling that this was the main club in Manchester at the time.
This is only 17 years ago.
This is not that long ago.
No.
I mean, now that I think the profile is much greater for Paralympic sport. Also, clubs and certainly some of the national governing bodies understand that Paralympic sport can bring funding their direction, because there's a decent amount of funding for Paralympic sport now, and that has really come about partly because of the lottery funding and how that was set up to help athletes, but also because of how the media now portray sport. You touched on it, you know, in 1988 when I went to Seoul, there was a 10-minute highlight package for the entire games on the BBC. And the kind of coverage that we had was the kind of thing where you'd say, well, you'd hear, oh, well, here's Simon Jackson and he's blind. And is it an amazing thing he can play the piano? Oh, and by the way, he won a gold in the judo. You know, that's the kind of coverage we were getting. And now we're up to, what, 360 hours of live, 650 live hours of live TV on Channel 4. For Rio. Now that's a huge shift. We've still got work to do. We're still building credibility. But there's some incredible athletes out there.
You're listening to Radio Newark Sport with the amazing Mark Woods. I'm back with Mark in a couple of moments' time. But of course, Saturday it did manage to stay dry, and everybody got a game of cricket in, or at least the ones of them that actually went to the cricket and didn't go to a wedding. So let's do a bit of this and have the cricket round up. It's not going to work, is it? Just the one night I wanted it to work, it's not going to work. There you go, it works.
I liked it when it wasn't working.
No, you do. You enjoy this, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Highlight of my week, Michael. Yeah,
there you go, you see. Our summer music, courtesy of our producer. I never said he was sport, eh? I just said he was a producer.
Thanks, producer.
Here we go. A winning draw and 16 points for Collingham. Batting first at Attenborough. 122-run opening partnership from Seb Medhaven and Jack Copley set the scene for 42 overs of 245-4. The home side, 151-6 in reply. 2 wickets for Fahad and, of course, the evergreen, David Pipes. Our other side in Division A, Bolton, came back from Plumtree with a massive 20 points. Chasing 210 for victory, they passed the total with 7 wickets to spare. Steve Ryder hitting a superb maiden 103 for the playing field side. Excellent result for them. So away from the top division, the match of the day was at Kelham Road, where 1 point separated second place Kimberley and third place Newark R&M Seconds. The good news is, it's now 17 points that separates them, as Peter Litchfield's 96 helped chase down the 204 required for victory, and he's smiling over there in the corner. The club's first team are almost there, with an 11th consecutive victory, this time at Bottom Club East Leek. And it means a win at Beaver on Saturday, and I think the celebrations could almost begin. Not such a good day for Farndon, though, indeed. The Trentside Derby at Fiskerton. Highlight from this one, 101 from the home sides, Dave Newby. The best of the rest, Gary Andrew at 48 for Newark R&M thirds. Josh Trant is 66 for Bolton seconds. And David Coote, 97 for Collingham seconds. Why was he in Collingham seconds? Who knows? Jonathan Todd in the same match. He had a memorable day, and I bet he's told everybody about it. Four catches and a run out. And wow. Finally, Neil Smith took 5 for 18 in Fiskerton thirds. Victory. And now to the tables. In A, Collingham move within 10 points of second place Ellerslie. And guess who's at Dalefield on Saturday? That should be a cracker. Bolton have a 39-point cushion over the bottom two after that win at Plumtree. I think they should be safe because the bottom two has only won 3 matches between them all season. In C, Fiskerton and Ferguson are close enough to be interested in promotion, but all the results went against Farndon and that gap to safety has opened up to 18. In E, Newark R&M are 64 points in front of Beaver. And Beaver's in 4th place, but they've got a game in hand. There's a maximum of 100 points to play for. Newark travel to the Vale on Saturday. Come on, Tony, you do the maths. I think if they take 20 points off Beaver, they're there.
Well, I know a certain umpire that should ensure that.
In F, Flintham lead the way with a 43-point cushion. Newark R&M's the second in K. Farndon look to be going in the opposite direction, though, and finally RHP. They're going to have to settle for a mid-table finish in Division L. Timing? What timing?
You couldn't write this stuff, could you?
You couldn't write it. A lot of people say we shouldn't. Still the football transfers to come, but going back to Mark, because I'm absolutely fascinated in this. I'm going to talk Olympics for a few minutes now, Mark. You've been to 5.
I always meant this distinction of Paralympics. I mean, it's nice that you kind of, you're bundling them
to
all
together.
To
me, they're Olympics.
Right, okay. Okay.
To me, they're Olympics. I think if people say the Paralympics, they're almost saying that it's second class. It is not.
Well, the Paris, that
they should be the first, to be honest.
Parallel too. I mean, that's why the name came about. But I always make that distinction because I wouldn't want people to think that I was passing myself off as an Olympian. But that's just how I do it. I'll leave it with you, though, mate.
I think you're letting yourself down there, Mark. I think it's I would say it's not on the par. It's better. It's bigger. More of an achievement.
Certainly I think every athlete has got a fascinating story behind them and face challenges just to even get to training on a day-to-day basis. So there's some very interesting characters there.
But to give you an example, if I'm a runner and God's given me a fantastic gift of running fast, well, I'm an Olympian. But a Paralympian, come on, that's a lot better.
When you have Usain Bolt in here next week, you'll be saying it totally the other way around. I know you will.
We couldn't afford him.
I think Usain Bolt will be saying it the other way around. And anyway, so what's the 5?
The 5 that I went to Seoul in 88, and then Barcelona was 92, Atlanta 96, Sydney 2000, Athens 2004.
The first, I suppose, is the one you remember the most?
Well, each game is very different, I think, and how you feel when you succeed or you fail is different as well, depending on what's going on in your life and how you performed on the day. So I mean, Seoul was an amazing experience as a 19-year-old going to Korea, winning some medals, probably did better than I thought I was going to do, but in hindsight could have done better if I'd have had the kind of awareness of how to handle that kind of situation. So that was a great games. I mean, Barcelona was great. It was very, very friendly. Really enjoyed Barcelona. Fantastic Olympic and Paralympic village. They had their own stretch of beach. They had their own Tenpin bowling alley. It was a pretty cool village. Atlanta was awful. There's no other way of saying it. The Paralympics were not going to make any money for the organisers in Atlanta, and they just were stripping it all away as we were trying to compete around it. So that was pretty poor. But then Sydney. Sydney was the big one for me in many ways, because I'd become a full-time athlete in 97 when lottery money became available for athletes. Prior to that, lottery money used to get spent on cattle projects. You know, you'd build a swimming pool, you'll build an opera house or whatever. But in 96, after the only Olympic medal was Steve Redgrave and Matthew Pinson, they realised that the athletes couldn't afford to use the facilities which were getting built. And you know, we were having to work, we were scraping by, and most a lot of the other big countries, were their athletes were virtually professional. So when lottery money came on in 97, it meant that I could then just train as a full-time athlete, most importantly, it meant I could rest properly. So I could rest properly in between every training session, and so I had three really good years, 97 through to 2000. But my father, who'd been my coach when I went to my first games, then when I moved away from home as my number one fan, he had a massive stroke just 2 days before I was due to go to Sydney, and died out of the blue. So he was 57, and I cancelled my flight, went to his funeral, rebooked my flight, went to Sydney. And so when we won the gold in Sydney as the relay, that experience was both the best of times and the worst of times wrapped in one. So when you say, if you say to me, what is the biggest moment in my career, it has to be that moment, because it was, there were so many emotions rolled into it.
You don't do easy, do you?
Well, I mean, life. I mean, when you get to my age, Mick, you'll I mean, life has a habit of throwing stuff at you, doesn't it? You know, and
I've been your age many times.
Yes, exactly. Thank you, father and bride.
So yeah, I mean, life does throw stuff at you all the time, doesn't it? And I think you know, you wouldn't always choose the things that happen to you, but you can choose the behaviours that you display when you're facing up to them. And that's how
a lot of people would say that the influx of money into particularly football has ruined the professional game. I mean, I'm going to quote some figures in a few minutes. It's totally obscene. But the input of lottery money has transformed a great many sports from a almost an unheard of sport by the millions that's out there, and put them into our... I mean, cycling is probably right there at the top of the list. What's your take on the... I know you mentioned lottery money, but how important has that been across the whole sporting spectrum?
It's been absolutely critical. If we want to be successful on the world stage, it's been critical to have some funding to support the athletes. And that funding enables them to have the best physiotherapy, the best coaches. It enables them not to have to work. They become totally immersed in... I mean, they talk about this no-compromise culture within UK sport, which has almost got some bad connotations now because certain things have gone wrong in some sports. But it's enabled athletes to really realise their potential. You know, we would never have been talking about taekwondo and Jade Jones being a double Olympic gold medalist, or cycling, or you know, or, well, the worst successful cyclist prior to...
But not to... Not to...
No, I mean, yeah, Chris Broadman obviously won a medal in 92, but it's made a massive difference across most of the sports. The challenge has become, though, that there is a limited pool of money, and certain sports like badminton was the big example. They lost their funding after Rio, despite winning Olympic medals, because the thought was that they didn't have the potential to be successful again. And it's become pretty brutal. And UK Sport have a policy of they would rather fund some sports 100% and get the best out of those sports than all sports at, say, 80% and not get the best out of those sports. Now, you could spend 3 or 4 hours talking about this, but there are some challenges around how the pot of money is shrinking, and we can't keep just chopping money away from the sports, because where do we put the value on? So let's say, for example, for me, one of the best gold medals in Rio was the women's hockey The gold medal in the women's hockey, fantastic for hockey, fantastic for women's sport. What value do you put on that compared to an extra gold medal in cycling? And that's the point that we've got to in British sport.
Big decisions to make. Big decisions. We're going to have a quick look at the circus that is the football transfers, and then we'll spend the rest of the hour and talking to Mark.
Radio Newark Sport, brought to you with Smith's Timber Merchants for all your fencing, decking and DIY needs.
Well, of all our ones to watch from last week, we've actually finally got a tick against one, Tony, with Naomi Matic going from Chelsea to Manchester United. Philippe Coutinho, £80 million, Liverpool to Barcelona. Liverpool can say no as many times as they wish, and I think so do you. It's going to happen.
No.
He's going. You say not. He is going.
I wouldn't.
Virgil van Dijk is another one. He's still walking around Southampton trying to find his dummy. If I can't go to Liverpool or Chelsea, I'm not playing for you. Well, rot in the reserves then. is the answer to that one. The big talk of the day is Danny Drinkwater. Leicester to Chelsea. Chelsea have managed to get rid of most of their midfield. It's now occurred to them that they haven't got any midfield players left. So Danny Drinkwater is apparently the answer.
No, Danny Drink Carrier.
Well, there you go. Newcastle want the Arsenal forward Lucas Perez. He's 28. He's got a £13 million valuation for an Arsenal team that didn't rate him good enough to play for them last season, even though they couldn't buy a goal at times. But suddenly he's worth £13 million. And it's a choice between Newcastle, Deportivo, Fenerbahce and an undernamed German club. Okay, I can't see Newcastle spending £13 million on anybody. And Alexis Sanchez has got over his cold. And he's arrived back at the Emirates to take up training. He's somebody else who's on the move, isn't he? Absolutely sure of it. And the Neymar saga continues. Is he going to Paris? Of course he's going to Paris.
I think that's a done deal, isn't it?
Of course he's going there. Nobody will stop it happening. Is the number two, number three at Barcelona? Is the number one in Paris? It's an ego thing, isn't it? That's all they want, is an ego thing. That's all they're bothered about. Typical footballer.
Radio Newark Sport, brought to you with Smith's Timber Merchants for all your fencing, decking and DIY needs on Appleton Gate, Newark. Visit smithstimber.co.uk.
So what about your home Olympics then? I mean, we said to Natalie last week, you qualify for the Olympics and you think, where's the next one? Is it sort of Japan or Australia or you know, somewhere exotic? And no, it's in East London.
Well, I'd have been honoured if I had been able to compete in that Games. I retired after Athens in 2004, and I mean, I knew I was due for retirement. When you can see your eyebrows in front of your goggles, you know. you two look like you both understand that comment. When you can see your eyebrows in front of your goggles, then you know that it's time to retire. So now, by the time it came through to London, I was a long way from being able to compete. And people say, oh, do you not miss competing? I'm like, well, I miss competing when I was fit, but there's nothing worse than competing when you're not fit. And it would have been a shambles if I'd have competed in London. But I was fortunate enough to be able to work on the Games with the media. So it was great. I used to do a radio show at the during the heats of the swim in the morning. I'd then go and do a more general radio show later on in the morning. I'd go and have some lunch, watch some basketball, some cycling, do the finals for the swimming, and once that was done, I'd walk over and watch the athletics. It was a pretty cool few weeks.
So actually the top two in this list is an ambassador for the 2012 London Olympics and a member of the British Paralympic Advisory Panel for the 2012 Games. What did those two entail?
Well, I mean, when it came to the ambassadorial work, was done actually by most athletes that had been successful at either Olympic or Paralympic Games up to that point, because it was really critical for the bid, when they were bidding for the London Games, to get the support of the general public, of the media, of the politicians. So every athlete was called upon to try and help with that. So it would be coming and doing interviews like this, it would be having conversations with people and being positive about the potential of having the Games come to London, because not everybody wanted it. But the athletes that have experienced the Games had experienced what it can do for a city and a country. So in many ways, we were all ambassadors doing this kind of work, really.
They always spoke, didn't they, about the London legacy. Mm-hmm. Has there been a London legacy?
I think in many ways we're only just beginning to see where there's a London legacy. I mean, certainly if you look at the Olympic and Paralympic teams and their success in Rio, we are the only nation ever to win more medals at the following games after our home games in both those competitions, and that's pretty special. So there's a legacy at the elite end, I think. And I thought we would win less, mainly because of people retiring once they'd done their home games. I think in terms of legacy, it's one of these things that I people are always saying, who's in charge of the legacy? Well, the answer is everybody's in charge of the legacy. Because if you watch that sport and you enjoyed the competition and you feel like doing sport, go and do sport. That's the legacy. You can't say, well, it's somebody else. Somebody else has to need to help me go and do that sport. So that's one point, is that everybody's involved in the legacy. The other thing is, you don't change people of a certain age. You don't change their behaviour. If you once you get over a certain, I'm not going to pick an age, I'm looking at you too, but actually, once you get to a certain age, it's hard to change behaviour. Right?
But he's right.
But you can inspire young people and set their behaviour in motion. And I think it's difficult to measure those kids which were, you know, 5 to 10 then. They're now, you know, 14 or so, maybe 10 to 14 now. It's difficult to measure how they're going to live their lives. It's very hard to measure. And legacy is more than just, you know, bums on seats, as they used to say. You know, it's more than just how many people are going out and doing something. It's about, you know, some of the behaviours, some of the leadership, you know, some of the moral standards that are set within the primary schools and secondary schools. It's a complicated question, and I've danced around it for you, Mick.
I ask a complicated question. That's a first. I think probably the one that probably give you the most heartache and the most satisfaction all in one is the trustee of the Teenage Cancer Trust, because it can be, obviously, it can be heartbreaking, but there again, there are the good stories.
Well, I mean, getting cancer at any age is brutal, and I felt particularly hard done by to get, you know, put in a geriatric unit, you know, full of guys your age. It was awful. It just didn't feel like the right place for me to be, you know, because at the end of the day, teenagers don't talk to old people, and they don't talk to young people, but they talk to each other. And so the Teenage Cancer Units create an environment, the best possible environment, for young people to get treated for their cancer. And they kind of self-support, really, through being together on the unit. So they reckon it has an impact on survival rate. And it's a lovely charity, lovely charity.
And the Youth Sports Trust, I'm assuming, is obviously slightly different, but the principle is
Youth Support Trust is about enabling and facilitating quality physical education in schools for all young people. So whether that's primary or secondary, they've got interventions that enable schools to get the best out of their PE lessons and get the best out of the young people. And it's not just about, you know, let's get everybody together and play 50-a-side rounders, you know, which I can remember doing when I was at school, where it's actually, if you're lucky, you might get to hit the ball once in the whole PE lesson. This is about very carefully thought out PE lessons which have an impact on the whole school. So it has an impact on behaviour. You know, you can have lessons developed for you which improves literacy, that improves arithmetic. You know, there's some clever stuff out there. There's money now for it through the sports premium. So the sports premium is, as you'll know, is funded via the sugar tax, and so there's a good amount of money goes into every primary school specifically for PE, and you can do a variety of things. You could resurface your playground, but equally you could buy into some very useful resources to enable your teachers to deliver quality PE, especially at primary school, where actually it's often taught by the teacher who is responsible for an entire class, and PE might not be their subject. So there's some great resource out there that Youth Support Trust can deliver.
One of the things that Tony and I are proud of what we do on this show is we champion primary school sports, because we both of us believe passionately that that's where you start playing your sport. Mm. You know, you come to Barnby Road School and you start playing your football, or in this day and age, almost any sport. And that's what you go on for your sporting career on. It's the base, isn't it, of your sporting career.
Well, if you don't engage young people into doing some form of physical activity by the time they're 10, they're just not going to do it, are they? I mean, it's hard. Even those which you engage, you then have a struggle when they start turning 14, 15, 16. So it's absolutely critical we get this right in primary school, because if you don't get it right there, it's very, very difficult to turn around again.
Should you always play sport to win? There's a school of thought at the moment, isn't there? And I know the headmaster here, I was with him when he used to play football, and he played to win. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And that's the ethos he's putting into these children here.
He played to maim.
Whereas there is a school of thought, isn't there, that it's not about winning, it's about taking part. Have you got to find, from your sort of ear in this?
There's a balance, obviously. You know, not every child can win. But I'm absolutely against schools that remove competitive sport from their offering, because if you can't support a young person that isn't successful at sport on sports day, for example, then that's not a reflection on the sport, that's a reflection on the school, because children fail all the time at school. They might not be great at mathematics, they might not be great at literacy. You don't remove those things just because some children fail at it. Sport is, for some children, is the one thing that they can do all the way through their schooling life. So I'm passionate about competitive sport still being in there. For me, when I talk to my children, I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, actually, but I don't know why I talk to either of them, because neither of them listen, really, but what I say to them, and eventually someone will listen.
No, possibly not.
This is where the old ones come into their own. They don't.
you know, I try to get my young ones just to do their best. You know, try and enjoy doing your best. And then the outcome is less relevant. Now, of course, it does feel great when you win, but if you enjoy trying to do your best, I take my 7-year-old daughter to judo, and I just say, you know, get stuck in, enjoy yourself, try and do your best. And that's, my father used to always say to me, you can't do better than your best. And if you can kind of focus on that rather than the win or lose issue, I think that will give you some longevity.
Sport at school was how I learnt to smoke.
Nice.
Because, like, in those days, if you weren't good and you weren't in the team, you just discarded to the side and you went round the back of the sheds and, you know, shared cigarettes.
Yeah. But it was in Yorkshire.
there are... Yes, I think we'd like to think we've got a little bit more subtle in how we deliver physical education in the UK.
quick one before the ad break. A BBC TV commentary. This is what's got me worried more than anything. BBC TV, you know, I mean, you have to be good to be on the BBC.
Well, you have to be available, certainly. I've done a little bit of that. I don't do a great deal. I've no aspiration particularly to be a commentator, but I'm happy to do it when somebody asks me. So the first thing that I did was in 2002 for the Commonwealth Games in Manchester. And then I've done a mixture of radio and TV. In fact, but I do like the radio. I like the radio more in many ways, because you can guide the conversation where you want it to go, whereas on TV you have to talk to the pictures and what the public can see at home. So it's nice to be able to just go with the ebb and flow, as you guys clearly do. yeah, I enjoy that.
Was that a compliment, Tony?
Yeah.
It was a backhanded compliment.
I think it's more on about ebbing.
I'm writing that down as a compliment.
Your flowing days are over, aren't they?
That goes in the left-hand column. A bit of a special tonight, talking to Mark Woods, and if you missed it earlier on, there will be a podcast of the whole show, but Mark lost his leg at the age of 17 through cancer and went on to represent his country in 5 Olympic Games, and there's also a list as long of your arm of what his organisations he is now with. But there's more! because this disability sports superstar, if you want to use those words again that I hate using, decided to develop his mountaineering skills in Nepal, Ecuador and Peru. He climbed the world's highest volcano, which is going to tell me what it's called.
It was highest active volcano. It's Cotopaxi.
Active?
Yeah.
Right.
You get up to the top, and there's a glacier that comes off the top of it, and the steam coming off the top. It hasn't erupted for a long while, and it didn't when I was there.
That one's in Ecuador. Then he went to France and climbed a 22,000 foot mountain.
No, there isn't a 22,000 foot
no, there
mountain
isn't.
In France.
No, that's in Nepal.
Yeah, that's right.
And what was the French one that I can't pronounce?
The French one.
Mont Pelvoux?
Oh, Mont Pelvoux, yeah. I actually ended up getting lifted off that via a helicopter because I went.
Been in a helicopter as well, and I.
My father used to be a winchman on an AC rescue helicopter.
Oh, you're my hero. Where at?
He was based all over. He was on an aircraft carrier for a while, but he was based all over. But I learned to swim because.
Was he ever at Cold Rose?
No, I don't think so.
Nearly my hero.
We learned to swim because swim is a life skill, and that's why he wanted to learn to swim. But yes, on Mont Pelvoux, what had happened was when I retired from swimming in 2004, I thought, well, I want to become a beginner at something. I'd enjoyed, you know, being an elite athlete, working on the little details, but then I wanted to become a beginner again, and. At something, so I thought, well, I don't know how to climb, I can't tie knots, I'll go and join the local climbing centre. I was in Manchester at the time and I joined the local climbing centre, but me being me, I got quite into it and I met a few people and I got friends with the owner and he took me to Chamonix and we did some climbing in Chamonix and then we went down to Mont Pelvoux and we climbed up this mountain and there was quite a long what they call a couloir, quite a long ice gully that we went up, and it was quite deceiving. We hadn't realised quite how steep it was, but I remember going up at one point, I had my two ice axes and my crampons in the ice. I could look between my feet and I was about 800 feet up and I was just tied to this other guy and we were climbing up and he said, are you okay? I said, I'm okay if you think we're okay, because he was the expert. Got to the top, much relieved, and I said, I'm okay as long as we can get back down. And he said, we'll be fine. And we turned around to go back down, and as we turned around, I heard him fall, and he slid past me down this ice gully, and I rolled over and did what you call an ice axe arrest, where you put your ice axe into the ice to break yourself. And I stopped him, because he was tied to me, from pulling me off the mountain, he was laying there and he said, I don't want you to panic. I said, I'm okay, I'm not panicking. He says, but I think I might hurt my leg. And he lifted up his trouser leg and his crampon had gone into the side of his leg and it popped his calf out, a bit like it looked like a fillet steak, just yes. Sat on the side of his leg. And he said, what do you think? I said, I don't know about you, John, but that doesn't look very good to me. He said, shall we call her for a helicopter? And I went, yeah, so I tried to get a number for a helicopter. I couldn't find out the number for a helicopter and found the number for a little hut that we'd stayed in the night before, this little French alpine hut. And I called up and I said, hello, you know the two English people that were here last night? We could do with a helicopter, please. And this helicopter, not long after, a helicopter came along and this guy came down on his wire, looked like the milk tray man. He came down and he landed next to me and he said, is it a helicopter for one or for two? And I'm like, it's for two. It's for two. We're both coming off this mountain. So what should have taken us 10 hours to walk down, it took me about 20 minutes. He dropped me in the car park. It was fine.
Why have we only got an hour?
I know, he's going to have to come back. He has got to come back.
You come out with that one and there's 4.5 minutes left. Come on.
Nepal, Ecuador... Yeah. Just off trekking. Well, they're not bad places to go trekking.
Oh, they're beautiful places to go trekking. I mean, I'd recommend anybody who enjoys a good walk to go to Nepal. I haven't been since the big earthquake, but I think, you know, tourism is a big part of their income, and so it'd be great to see people keep going there. Not just the Everest region. People tend to go to Everest Base Camp. I really enjoy going on the other side to Pokhara, the Annapurna National Park. It's beautiful around there.
There's lots more stories to come here. Yeah. We're quickly running out of time, but there is a book.
I've written a few.
There is a book.
I've written a few books, yeah. The one
in your spare time.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I don't intend to do anymore, but if you've enjoyed some of the stories I've shared this evening, then the book is Personal Best, and it's a combination of some of my stories, how I might have stayed motivated doing things, what other people think about motivation, maybe what my coach thinks about motivation. So it's a combination of things. It's called Personal Best.
The last one, Tony, this one, just at the bottom. Mark currently works for many organisations such as RBS, Barclays, IBM, Adidas, GSK, John Lewis Partnership, the BBC and Carillion. Well, you know, they're not bad companies to work with.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I earn my living now. So I go around the world doing a kind of speaking circuit, telling stories like I have this evening, I guess. But really trying to engage with people into the challenges that organisations have, you know, trying to get the best out of people.
There must be a lot of money in John Lewis, judged by the price of my wedding suit.
You see, the Yorkshireman's coming out in him.
But they charge by per metre, though, don't they? Per metre of material.
You won't get the last word if somebody wins a living through it.
The waistcoats for a small fortune.
Yes, doubled up as a marquee.
I'm just sitting back while Tony's being slaughtered. The future for sport, disabled sport, there you are. I'm saying it again because unless you can tell me what else to call it. The future, I think it's bright in the fact that we are now all part of it, and these guys and girls are household names.
I think the fact that we talk about it and that the more people understand what it is a very positive thing. The pathways for young people with disabilities are improving. They're still not as clear as they might be for your regular able-bodied kid. To get into a sport and into a club, but the pathways are getting clearer, and there is funding for those that are at an elite level, but times are difficult and funding is reducing, but if we can encourage young people, whether they've got a disability or not, to engage into sport and physical activity, then eventually, through the nature of how these things work, we will also be successful at the other end of the pyramid as well. So at the moment, I'm focusing on the engaging with young people into sport, getting them interested and enthusiastic.
It shouldn't be called disabled sport. It should be just called sport.
It should be called
sport.
Well,
it is just sport, but the distinction is made certainly by the people who fund it. And some clubs certainly make the distinction. But for me, I think a good coach is able to adapt their knowledge regardless of the person they're coaching. And if you look at football teams, rugby teams, the knowledge has to be adapted for each of the participants. And a person with a disability just needs a further adaptation of knowledge.
And that, I'm afraid, means time's up. Mark, thank you so much for tonight.
Pleasure.
It's been the hour's flown by. It's been absolutely fascinating. And tomorrow night, Poppy Miller's flying in from America to talk to us.